the great thing is about sex is that I believe we can all learn to become great lovers to ourselves and to others. It's not about like a checklist. You know what I mean? It's all connected. So I would say like the richer experience of being a sexual person and being involved in this way is just that like I'm very self-aware.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 69 of the Mad Happy Podcast. This is Mason, and today, I mean, what better way to celebrate episode 69 than to talk to Dr. Emily Morse, author and host of Sex with Emily. I promise that we did not plan this. It is just a beautiful coincidence that for episode 69, we'll be talking about sex on the show for the first time. Definitely a taboo topic, but it was really refreshing and cool to talk to Emily. I've never been so open about my sexuality before and my sexual history and sexual preferences, and we've really get into a lot of stuff that I never really expected I would share on this show. I think one of the most awakening things for me was just how inherently tied sexual health and mental health are. That was a theme that we just kept coming back to, with themes that each of us were bringing up through our own experiences, different things that she is really trying to get across, and like different things that she touches on in a lot of the work that she does. They're just so connected. And I think sexual health is really underrated in terms of its place in the mental health conversation. You know, we haven't even talked about it on this show before. So it was super eye-opening, and I really think it does have a place right up there with physical health and mental health when we always talk about those being the same thing. I mean, when you think about anxiety in the bedroom, or, you know, worried about not being able to perform, or how you look, or any of these things, they're all so closely tied to our feelings and our minds and our insecurities. And so much of sex is psychological. And I know that we can all relate to that. And we all have so much to learn from Dr. Emily. Is just such an OG. I mean, she's had her podcast for 15 years. So it's really like one of the OG podcasters in the space, has written a couple books that have sold really, really well. She actually has a new book coming out that we touch on a little bit. It was funny. I actually found out that she grew up in Michigan and knew a lot of my family and my mom, and we went to the same summer camp. So that was also really awesome to connect about. She shares a lot of really cool tips and different kind of advice for people who might be, you know, trying to spice things up or looking to try something new, or just where to start when it comes to how to talk about sex and how to really improve our sex life and how to continue to destigmatize sex. And with that being the big question, that's the number one similarity with mental health, where her answer, I won't give it all away, but it's just, we got to talk about it, right? All of these things that are going on in our lives that we're all experiencing, the number one thing that we can do is just talk about them. And that's why we're doing this show, to talk about them. And I hope you guys enjoy Emily and I talking about our sexual health. So without further ado, enjoy episode 69 with Dr. Emily Morse. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with Dr. Emily Morse. Well, I think it's so funny. Most of the guests that we have on, and we talk about their mental health journeys and their experience, and obviously starting at the beginning is such a good indicator of who we are and why we are. And you happen to grow up where my mom and dad did also. So I think that it's really interesting for me to get the perspective from you, because I often don't hear about their experience. But tell us a little bit about where you grew up, like what that was like, kind of your family environment as a kid and how that was.
Let's see. I grew up in Michigan, yes, suburb of Detroit. Like Farmington Hills, Bloomfield Hills, Southfield, at Michigan. And it was, I think it was a nice place to grow up. I think that Michigan is, we have like really good, seems like we have really good values. There was you know, a lot of nature, a lot of outdoors. And so like growing up, we played with the kids in the neighborhood. It felt like very safe up until I was about 8 years old. And then life wasn't as great with my family. But growing up in Michigan was amazing. And summer camps was like the best thing that ever happened to me. Went to summer camp, but family stuff was interesting. Like, my parents got divorced when I was young, like 8 or 9.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a little bit different. So things were hard. I'm like, Michigan was beautiful and life is hard.
Yeah. I always say both my parents are from Michigan, but then I moved to LA when I was 3 years old. So I always say like, I kind of grew up in LA, but with these Midwestern values. And I think that's been so crucial for like my development and just the way that I see the world. And I always feel very grateful to my parents for kind of instilling that in me. And I can also relate to you on my parents getting divorced. It happened a little bit later in life when I was 16 years old. But just for me in that moment, it just kind of turned my world upside down. Mm-hmm. And I think really made me think back about my childhood and you know, what was going on, analyzing certain things, having some things that were relief and clarity and other mm-hmm. things that caused more confusion. But yeah, I'm curious for you. Obviously, you were a lot younger, but how do you feel like that sort of affected you at the time? And like, even if you didn't realize, what were some of your like coping mechanisms, or like, where did you go?
Well, I think it's so interesting to even hear you say that, like at 16 or at 8, we're never prepared for it. I think what happens is we go along with a certain belief as children. For me, and I was like, oh, parents are together. And then, you know, then they're not. And it's confusing because one of the big challenges, our parents love us. They want to do the best they can, but they don't even know how to communicate it, usually in a way that we need to be heard. I think as children, like my experience was that there just wasn't a lot of information out there about how to explain to a child, you know, what it means that when like their foundation is destabilized. Mm. And so I think for me, it was, you know, hard to, well, what happened in my family too, was that there was a lot of, we'll just get into it here. There was a lot of like divorce. And so my parents got divorced, but then they got remarried and divorced. So there's a lot of different iterations of marriage and separations in my family, divorces. So it was, I feel like which is kind of probably more like your parents' generation. I feel like we were raised more of like the latchkey generation anyway. We were kind of all sort of raising ourselves. And then on top of that, you take a family that wasn't really together, providing a lot of support. So I think as a result of that, I also am grateful. I'm very independent, right? I feel like in many ways I raised myself, set my own rules, my own, you know, my own ways of living in the world. But it definitely is challenging to kind of, as a kid, to kind of have to figure out how to, you know, make sense of the world when a lot of people's parents are still together. And, you know, I think it definitely impacts your understanding of commitment and relationships and love and all those things.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother.
Yeah. I know that was really helpful for me. Like when that happened, I feel like it really brought me and my siblings a lot closer together. Like I'm one of five and have somewhat of a blended family. So for us, that was like an experience where we really became a tight-knit unit and kind of turn to each other. And I always find that what's so beautiful about those hardships and moments like that, which is so much of what Mad Happy is about, is all of the beautiful like lessons and benefits that really come out of that. And so much of what we try and talk about as a brand is like, it is inevitable that we will suffer and struggle and have bad days. Those are all normal parts of life. And instead of really trying to act like those aren't happening or feeling shame around them or trying to minimize them, like, if we can actually champion those moments and like really be proud that we're going through them, then we're able to learn so much about ourselves and our relationships and the world around us and all of these things, so that we can be just more fulfilled and like more true to ourselves when we happen to come out of them, because those times are temporary.
So was that your experience then with, it's such a different way, with the siblings, like you felt like it was normalized and you all got to kind of talk about in real time how it was affecting you? Is that what you're saying your experience was?
Yeah, I mean, my mom put me in therapy when I was 7 years old. So her father was a psychologist and that was really instilled in her. So I've always been encouraged to talk about my feelings and I'm naturally just kind of this sensitive empath. So like I've always said, that's somewhat of my blessing and my curse. And I think I'm able to like, I was able to build an emotional toolbox at a really young age and be able to articulate myself and all these sorts of things. So I think I kind of became that for my siblings and was really like pushing them to share and open up about how they were feeling. And then now with what I'm doing on the Mad Happy side, I feel very lucky and like blessed that I've been able to incorporate that into my work. And I'm still a total work in progress. By no means do I have it figured out in any way. But yeah, I don't know how to live life any other way.
That's good. Yeah. Well, we're never done, just so you know, we're all a work in progress. And I think that's a big thing to people understand, is that it's a journey, that you don't ever arrive and you're like, I have it all figured out, my mental health, my physical health, all of it, sexual health, it's never all figured out. But I think it's the noticing and it's the mindfulness and paying attention to where you're at and having compassion with yourself and also surrounding yourself by people who speak this kind of language.
So. Totally. Well, We were so excited to have you on. I think like one of the reasons why I was so pumped is we've never really talked about sex on the show in any capacity. And I've opened up about like my experience with being a sex and love addict and struggling with like pornography addiction at times and like and a lot of the ways that sex and my relationship with it has kind of plagued me and my addictions. But I feel like it's something that impacts everyone and yet we don't really talk about it that much. Like super similar to mental health. I think there's a lot of parallels. Obviously sex and mental health are so intertwined. Sex and relationships, sex with ourselves, like all of these things. There's such a myriad of topics that I know are so relevant for our listeners and everyone around the world. But I guess for you, like why sex? Like how did you start even talking about this or becoming passionate about it or where did that start?
Yeah. Such a good question. And I thank you for sharing that about yourself. I know you already have to your audience, but it's tricky because we really don't. Well, really, I started because I really had zero sex education growing up. It was still very taboo to talk about. Even though I grew up in a very like liberal home where there wasn't shaming around it, which is a huge problem for so many people. For me, it just was absent because our parents don't know really how to talk. No one knows how to talk about it. So what happened was I was having sex. This is like my second career, like in my 20s. And I thought it was okay. It wasn't great. I thought sex was sometimes good, sometimes not. And I was trying to understand the correlation between like, how do you stay in a long-term relationship? Like, how do you have like an excellent, sexy, long-term relationship and so on, have sex with that person? Right? We all see like the divorce statistics and you realize that so many marriages end in divorce. And a lot of times sex was the culprit, at least in my younger years. I'm like, well, people can't seem to stay together and they're not having sex. And also my own journey was that when I was having sex, I realized that it seemed to me that the guys I was having sex with were having a lot of pleasure and a lot of orgasms. And I was like, what, this seems like there's a disparity here. And when I went to look for information, there really wasn't any information. There was really nobody talking about sex. And there was like Dr. Ruth, who was kind of the first person talking about sex in America. You know, she's like in her 90s right now, and she still is. And I kept looking for information. And then I guess in my mind too, because I'm an overachiever, I thought sex seems like something that would be amazing to be an expert at. And to every time go into this situation that's supposedly pleasurable and satisfying and connective, like, what if I could really figure that out for myself and help others? So I started a podcast 17 years ago, interviewing people about their sex life and their relationship. And yeah, it was one of the first podcasts. It was definitely the first sex podcast. But what I realized was right when I started it, and I was not an expert, I didn't have a doctorate in human sexuality. I was just like, when I hear people talk about sex, like a lot of friends would be like, last night sex was amazing. And I'd always say, like, what do you mean by that? Like, what made your sex so amazing?
Right.
Like, why? Like, what is, you know, people, I'd be like, did you have 16 orgasms? Like, was his penis double jointed? Like, what makes great sex? So that was like the first like few episodes, right? And then I came to find out that a lot of people really didn't know. A lot of people had a lot of shame around sex. Many people were faking orgasms or were faking relationships or were just like kind of confused because the messaging out there is a lot of it's through porn or it's absent, right? So if we only go to porn and we assume that everything we see in porn is actually accurate, which many people do, right? We're told like, don't talk about sex or don't have, I mean, it might've been a little bit different when you were growing up, but for me, it was like, don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And our sex ed was like, there was nothing. It was like, don't get pregnant, don't get an STD, right? But then you go and have sex and no one's telling you how to do better. So I found out there was a whole bunch of people in that same place. And so that's how I started it. I started talking to people and studying sex and went back to school and got my doctorate. And I realized this was my life's work. Like after my first show, I was like, oh, this is gonna change people's lives. Like this conversation hasn't been done before. And we need more of this because it's pleasure.
Yeah.
It's like, shouldn't be shameful. Like, let's realize the root of it and like, try to remove that so we can get back to the good parts of sex.
Totally. And on the education piece, I think that's the first place that my mind goes of like, when I think of sex ed or like when we first learn about this, like, is it from a weird counselor or an uncomfortable conversation with your parents or like how you're getting this information? And obviously there are so many parallels to mental health too, in terms of how taboo it is, but just currently now, like what does the sex education system like look like in schools? Is it still that person that kind of comes in who's awkward and like is kind of explaining things in a weird way, or like has that evolved at all, or like how are we introducing this to kids right now?
Oh my God, this is why I get up every day and why I'm still so passionate about this, because what I can't believe is that it hasn't changed much at all. So we talked about this. We have some mutual, like I have a niece that's around, you know, in her early 20s and went to like a great school. And I realized like afterwards she graduated that I got together with 20 of her friends and nothing had changed in the 20 years since I've been in school. That what happens in the education is, you know, yeah, someone comes in for a day and teaches it. I mean, for me, it was like, yeah, half a day and it hasn't changed much. And they tell you about, you know, your reproductive system. Essentially, the message is don't get pregnant, try not to get an STD, and, you know, basically don't have sex. That's why so many schools teach abstinence. So only 13 states in America, maybe it's 17 now, require sex ed to be medically accurate. Okay. And the majority of states don't even have it as a requirement. And in fact, what we're seeing right now with, you know, Roe being overturned as well, there's the same states that do not have accurate sex ed or any sex at all are also the same states that are, you know, overturning Roe, that their women don't have any rights to. So it's really, really bad right now, to be honest. So what's happening is that it's actually getting worse and our kids are not getting the information that they need and they are still really have to find their own resources. So I am actually working on a sex education program right now. And I've been working with like a lot of different like younger groups of young women. I'm doing a TV show about this right now too, about sex education and helping just make it more mainstream because this is just a disservice to all of us, but it's not looking great. Got a lot of work to do.
Do you find that there's a big movement and allies that are with you of like trying to make this change in schools, or is it a small megaphone right now?
I think it's a small megaphone. Here's the amazing thing. Like I'll tell you the great news about it, that in the almost two decades I've been doing this, there are so many more people right now who are really passionate about it and who are trying to change the way we educate youth, who are creating their own programs or trying to get into schools. But when you have the school system, and I can just speak for, you know, in America, when you have the school system here that is against it, adamantly against it.
Yeah.
It's really hard. You have to like, you know, and the problem that we also face is that the parents, while well-meaning, they also didn't have sex education. So my audience of my show of Sex with Emily is literally 18 to 83. And everyone's asking the same questions because
no one got the information.
So I'm almost at this point where I'm like, we got to go in big and have everyone talk about it because the parents are like, well, you know, I don't know what to say either. Or my parents didn't talk about it and I still have baggage. So, you know, looking for places for kids to go that is accurate and reputable is tricky. But the good news is there are more educators out there and there are more people trying to help.
Yeah. And like in your mind, ideally, what should that introduction or education look like? You know, I think to some degree, regardless, you have 13-year-old kids going through puberty. Anything you tell them is going to be funny or uncomfortable or a stranger. Like it might not even matter what's coming out of their mouth. But like, I know it's a bigger question than this, but what do you wish that they were teaching? What are some of those introductory things that would be so helpful for kids at that age still?
Okay, well, I think it's a great question. I can actually answer it easily because there's only one place that I know of in the world that actually teaches comprehensive sex education, and that's in the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, you go there and you realize that they start teaching it at a very young age, meaning when the kids are, and there's a lot of sex educators I know that, you know, the dream is to model something after this system, but it's tough. So let's say when the kid is with your baby, your toddler, right? And like, think about when you were little and your parents are like, these are your toes and your knees and your thighs and your stomach, right? In America, they jump right over like this whole part of your body. You're like, what is this called? Are you saying that this has no name? They're like, okay, right. So from a very young age, we're like told that this part of your body, or we call it a wee wee or a hoo ha.
Right.
Parts. Yeah. So in the Netherlands, like a toddler, they name the parts. This is your vagina. This is the penis. We use the accurate terms used to describe our body parts. So there's no shame in it.
Right.
And then as kids get a little bit older, right? Like let's say a kid touches themselves, right? What happens in America? You put your hand down your pants, which kids are going to do. Babies are going to do that. Mm-hmm. What happens now in America? So what we do is we might shame them or say that's wrong or pull your hand away or that's just private. Some of that's okay to say that it's private, but again, it's like, that felt good. And from a pre-verbal age, I'm told that it's not okay. But when we go to countries like in the Netherlands, they're going to say, oh yeah, that feel, they're going to acknowledge it. That feels good. Okay. Yeah. That's when you touch these, you kind of meet kids where they're at. So whatever they can understand at that age, again, that feels good, but that's just for you to touch right now. Right. And then as they get older, they just normalize it. Any questions kids have, they talk to them about when kids get a little bit older, like they'll talk to them about puberty, like what it actually means. Like you might wake up in the middle of the night and have an erection if you have a penis, right? And if you are a boy, you might have these dreams and this could happen. And if you're a girl, this could happen to you. And you talk to them about masturbation, you talk about feelings they might have, like crushes they had in school. And mm-hmm. you know, just, it's like they just, it, every year there is sex education in the schools. And then it goes on like that. And the pair, they talk about the other huge difference, which I can't believe I haven't even said yet, is that they still talk about STDs and STIs and pregnancy, but they also talk about pleasure. They also talk about orgasms, and they talk about the health benefits of masturbation, and they don't make it weird and awkward. And so what they find is that, you know, there's fewer unwanted pregnancies there. There's less porn addiction. There's less, you know, just dissatisfaction with sex, right? It's just because it's part of the family. And you talk about it at the dinner table, and it's not weird or creepy, and it's accurate. So that's the world that I see.
Yeah. The bottom line, I think, is just talk about it. Like, as simple as that is, it's just communicate it. Like, don't act like it doesn't exist. And I know I've made this reference a couple of times now, but it's so strikingly similar to what we talk about in terms of mental health awareness. Is like, you meet people where they're at. You don't have to be an expert. Like, you just really talk to someone and ask them these questions and how are they feeling and really respond to them. And what we found so much in the mental health conversation in terms of why it's been so stigmatized, especially, is because people only think about it in that negative sense of mental health means depression, mental health means suicide, mental health means anxiety, like all these really scary things that we don't want to talk about. And there's so much pleasure around mental health too, of like, that also means joy, and that also means laughter and happiness. Like, those things are also mental health. So when we talk about it at Mad Happy, like, we really try and do it through the lens of optimism and like really try and get the point across of like, mental health is this wide spectrum that like can exist on this huge plane, and it's not just all this like negative stuff. And we found that like people really respond to that well.
I love that you're doing that. That is exactly the same thing. It's like, we have to talk about all of it, and we have to be authentic and real. And when we talk to someone about it, we have to be curious and not critical, and we have to be open. And so it's the same kind of things, but yeah. There is a lot of shame around it. And I love to see what you guys are doing for mental health, because finally people are talking about it, right? Like, the fact that we are here, it's really, it's all important. It's all connected, sex and mental health. And
yeah, no, it is. And I'm curious, like, to the extent at which it's connected, like in the people that you talk to and work with, I feel like when I think about some of my sexual history or my experiences, there's so much of my anxiety tied to it, of like performance anxiety, or like, did I do good? Or like, are they going to think of that? Like, whatever, just like all of these things we're living in our head all day and constantly overthinking. Have you found them to, like, a lot of these mental health things coming up a lot in your work and the people that you work with?
Absolutely. I mean, huge. I mean, I have to say, like, anxiety during sex is a huge factor that's contributing to people's dissatisfaction and disconnection. Anxiety, depression, medications, you know, that can significantly affect people's sexual response and their ability to, you know, enjoy sex. People have like eating disorders or body image, confidence in those areas, you know, bipolar. It can help with like just any chronic illnesses. I mean, there's so many things that are going to impact it. But I would say, just for the first thing, anxiety, what I think is so interesting, and which is why I love we're having this conversation, is that people also think they're very separate. They put sex in this silo and they're like, sex is a performance. Like, I came in, I did well, I did all the moves. Like, I went to like a spinning class and I did the sex and now I go home. No, your entire life is part of it. Like, if you're an anxious person, well, you're going to have those intrusive thoughts during sex. If you're depressed, you know, you might never be in the mood for sex. So then you're going to go on an antidepressant, and guess what? That antidepressant is likely going to impact your sex drive. But knowing you can't have orgasms, that people don't tell you that. So it's like, it's all so connected. And so is your joy, and so is your enthusiasm. So if you learn how to ground yourself and find places that do set you up for sex successfully. In fact, I was talking about my book. I was just writing this chapter in my book and talking about how our thoughts, I talk about this all the time, is that that to really get curious during sex, that we have to get more mindful and present, which is kind of the antidote to so many of this, of our worries, is to be present, have a mindfulness practice, a breathwork practice. And the same things that I would do to calm my nervous system or when I'm really anxious are the things I would do in the bedroom as well. So I try to give people those tools and say, like, you know, it's okay if you get these thoughts during sex or you're worried, or especially for, you know, if you have a penis, you often think like, I gotta be hard. I gotta be in charge. I gotta lead this thing. Like, it's a lot of freaking pressure, right? And then if you have a vulva, you're like, I should be orgasming every time. I should whatever. So we all bring our worries and our concerns and these intrusive thoughts into the bedroom, like every time we have sex. So a lot of what I do is help people get out of their own ways, right? And recognize it, honor it, but kind of create a space for sex where you have a partner, if you're, you know, that you can talk to it about. You're like, I'm getting anxious. Can we do that thing where we like breathe together for 5 seconds, you know, 5 deep breaths and look into each other's eyes and reset? You know, like I will literally do things like that. I'll say like, I'm having a thought. I just lost my, you know, and they can tell and then it becomes a shared experience. But since we're so feel like with sex, we're on our own. We're like, I got to figure this out myself, how to be a good lover. It's like, you can really collaborate and co-create sex in a lot of ways. And by revealing these things.
It's so funny because it's like one of the most intimate things and we experience it so alone. Like most of the time, even like with our partners, like you are being as intimate as you could possibly be with another human. And yet like you're scared to say that like, I'm uncomfortable or can we do that again or whatever, which is like silly and backwards.
See, that's like a mic drop experience right there. I think that we're so, it's so intimate, but yet we all feel so alone.
Yeah.
It's true. This is what I do. I like help couples and individuals feel more connected to it because most of our experience is exactly what you're saying. I'm in my head. And that's what a lot of people I work with are like, I've come here to fix my sex life with my partner, but they won't talk about it. It's all my job or vice versa. And it's like, you guys are in this together, you know, like, let's talk about it. It shouldn't be so lonely. You know, there should be a lot more pleasure in this thing that's supposed to be the most incredibly pleasurable act in the world. Right.
So, yeah. And I can really relate to what you were saying earlier about, you know, sex is kind of like it ebbs and flows in relationships. You know, I think about my current relationship and in the beginning, the sex was fantastic and we were so like magnetic with each other and then, you know, really fell in love. And I've been with this woman for over 3 years now, but we hit a time period probably last year where I was feeling somewhat depressed. I started watching more and more porn and like we went months and months without having sex. And I'm just curious, like in couples that you work with, like what do you see? Like, why is it so common that like couples go through these lulls of like, we still love each other so much, right? The love and the care is there, but for some reason that sexual energy and connection just gets unplugged. And then for me, at least once it's unplugged, it just is so weird and uncomfortable to try and plug it back in that you'd rather just not. And then before you know it, it's like, oh shit, it's been 3 months or four months. God. And like, then it just, you kind of feel stuck.
That's the exact challenge that so many couples face. And this is why, again, this is what my other experience leading up to sex with Emily was that starting the show was that in my 20s, I had a series of relationships. They were about 6 months to 2 years. And I realized when I got to a certain point in every relationship, I no longer was as attracted to him anymore. And I thought that that means that you need to end the relationship. We had way less knowledge into. I was like, oh, well then, and there was always someone else, something else that was like shinier and hotter and sexier that I was like, well, this person turns me on. So clearly this is where it's going to end. Come to find out now that this is the most normal experience in the world. And if we could just normalize this part of relationships, that what you're describing here is the honeymoon phase, which is actually your like NRE, new relationship energy, which literally every single relationship is going to go through. Think of it this way. So when we're falling in love with someone, right? And it's actually a biological condition. 6 months to 2 years is this NRE or honeymoon phase, whatever you want to call it. Because in this time, you have the most delicious feel-good cocktail of hormones that are just like, honestly, they look at the brainwave patterns of people falling in love and it's the same as people doing cocaine. Because all those pleasure centers are lit up in your brain because this person is new and it's novel and it's exciting and everything's changed. I've never kissed this person this before. I've never seen this person's body before. Like it's so exciting, but just like everything and every high, there's going to be a low. Like that's the easiest way I can describe it is that new sex with almost anyone, because you probably wouldn't be with them, is going to be great. And the other challenge with that new sex is that there's not a lot of talking that needs to happen. Like, everything's pretty good, right? You're like, we don't really need to talk about arousals and turn-ons because we're always in the mood because it's new and exciting until it's not. And then we think, this person's like, doesn't like me or they're not attracted to me. I'm not attracted to that. What's wrong? And then everything that you just went through, which is like So what the exciting thing is, and which is why I also love that we're bringing this up, is like, that's the place. I mean, ideally couples talk about this beforehand. I try to, that's what I try to do, is get people to be like, let's just recognize, like, I even joke, like with my partner, I'm like, well, we're still in the honeymoon phase, babe. Like, I joke about it because I know I'm like, this is all great right now, but let's just wait a few months, because this is, but we do though, in my relationship, we have deeper conversations. Are like, what are your turn-ons? When do you, which times of day do you want to have sex? Like, what feels the best to you? And I continue to, it's what I recommend couples do, is like, talk about your sex life now, when it's exciting and it's new in the early stages, but it's never too late. So now you have a great opportunity to say, because if you're in a place right now where you're like, yeah, I hear you, because probably many who are listening are in this place. They're like, yeah, it's gotten kind of stale. And this is where you have to start having conversations with your partner about your sex life. That happen. I have these three T's of communication that I talk about all the time. I know it's helped many people. They're on my website at sexwithemily.com. It's just like called the three T's. It's a free guide. Just check it out. It's timing, tone, and turf. And so if you're listening and you're like, I have never talked to my partner about sex, like, how do I even bring it up? This is how you do it. You find a time that is hanging out. Maybe you're on a date. Date night, you're in a casual place, you're not like stressed out, right? You are, that time is good. You're not hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, right? You're like cult, as I say, you're chill. And the tone is light, is curious, not critical, and it's open. It's like, let's kind of, it's collaborative. And the turf is outside the bedroom. And this is key. A lot of people think that when something happens that's sexual, you're going to bring it out around the bedroom. Like, why did you reject me again? Or why are we not having sex anymore? But I love to encourage people to keep the bedroom for sleeping and sex. Like, but don't have like deep conversations about anything. So the turf is great when you are, maybe you're on a road trip or you're going for a walk. So you're like moving, right? You don't have to make eye contact directly, but because it's hard for people, right?
Yeah.
So you're talking and then you say something like this. Hey, I realized that, you know, I realized that we've never really like talked about our sex life. And I know that sounds weird, but like, I feel like I want to be a great lover to you. And I assume that you want the same things. And I realize that we haven't been having sex and I don't know why. And I have all these things in my head about why, you know, have you thought about why? Let's like figure it out and can kind of start with that. You could start with, if it's not really a problem, but you just know it's not really, you know, do you really just, well, let me just say that. You could start it in that way. I have different scripts for people depending on whether. So let me just say that. But it could also just be like, for many people, they're like, it's just boring, but like, we're still having sex. You could say, babe, let's talk about the three most memorable times you've had sex and write that down and switch pieces of paper. And they'll switch their phones out, like text each other. And then you're like, oh, wow, I remember that time. That was great. Like, let's try to do that again. And then you can figure out, oh, that's because we were on vacation and we haven't had a vacation in 9 months. So we need to go away for the weekend. Or maybe you learn something I've heard, like, oh, was that time that like someone almost walked in on us and that was thrilling to you? So then you learn, well, maybe they're into like voyeurism or, you know, someone watching. You just get a lot of information about your partner's like desires and turn-ons by just talking about it. So those are like ways to have the conversation. But the other thing is why this happens is because we become very set in our ways and how we have sex becomes rote, just becomes a little bit stale after a while. And so what we're missing is novelty, something new, one thing new. It could be a conversation, it could be a toy, it could be a position, it could be in the next room, it could be in the living room instead of the bedroom. And we miss spontaneity too, because at the beginning, again, it was really spontaneous. So how do we make it, like, how do we have sex that's a little bit more spontaneous, you know? And how do we have variety? How do we do different things? So those are all the elements, or the kind of the starter kit for kind of figuring out what direction you can go into to connect more deeply with your partner and figure out how to keep the spark alive.
Yeah. And I feel like there's this false narrative too, that I even caught myself thinking that I was going to challenge you on. And then I was like, wait, that's so dumb. Of like, if you talk about sex or like you try and plan it, like that's not sexy, right? Like that's like, that's going to make it so planned and then it's not spontaneous or whatever. But I feel like that's just kind of a, like a traditional way of thinking. That's just not really true. Of like, if you actually talk about something, you can make it better. And like, see what the other person likes and like be able to create a dialogue around it and instead of just like thinking that it's cheesy or whatever.
Exactly. And so that's what I'm urging you. That is, so you're exactly where everyone is. They're like, well, if I talk about sex, well, first we think my partner's a mind reader. Like they should know. They should know that I've told them before that this is what I want. And if I have to tell you to, you know, to grab me and kiss me or throw me on the bed, then you actually don't want to do it because I've told you. Like there's all these But if you actually, like I said, like you talk about it, first off, it becomes really like hot. It gives you more depth in the relationship, more connection. And it's like, it just becomes so much easier, right? Well, you got to get through that, like, this is weird and awkward. And then I also have to say that I talk to couples a lot who, when I get them over this, like, this makes it not fun anymore, because we have this notion that sex should always be exciting and spontaneous, which it's really often isn't. That when you kind of plan it, that people think, you know, again, they're like, oh, planning sex, like, I don't want to look at my calendar and be like, pick up dry cleaning, like, send me Cal invite for sex. However, what I found is when couples say, like, they plan it, they're like, okay, because I know that, like, for example, in most relationships, there's one partner who wants it more than the other. There's high desire, low desire. That's how it is 99% of the time. It's kind of a bummer. Usually the two high desires don't come to bed. It just doesn't work. But then if you know that, you're like, okay, we're going to have sex on Saturday night. And then you know that you both, the person who's the high desire doesn't have to feel rejected when his partner tried or her partner tried to have sex again on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, because you're like, right, we planned Saturday. So then you can both look forward to it, and you can like send a sexy text, or you can figure out some scenarios, or listen to audio erotica, or like find some fun things to do. And then you both are looking forward to it. You know what's happening. And it's like, maybe again, it's like a new location, a new bottle of lube, like something different. And you've time to, like, you know, get aroused or get in the mood or just shave or whatever we need to do.
Yeah.
To repair it. So it kind of takes a lot of the guessing and a lot of the anxiety away from it.
Yeah. Me and my partner have started talking about it so much more, because it was a big problem for her, obviously. And like she's that higher driver a lot more than me. And obviously I was going through all my own shit that, like, I wasn't showing up there in the right way for her. And we kind of had some things going on, like some struggles in our relationship, and somehow, some way, like, we started having sex so much more, and like we noticed that and like had been talking about that, like, it's like, is this healthy? Like, is sex kind of serving as like a band-aid now? And then like now we're in this place where we're having sex like more frequently, and like it's better than it's ever been before, like even in the beginning. So it was making me think, and I'm curious to ask you, like, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering, like, how do you know what like healthy sex looks like, unhealthy sex? Like, are we using this to avoid something else, or is it ever too much? Or like, how are you able to identify like when it's healthy or not?
Wow. Well, first off, those are such, I love all your real life examples here, because that's exactly it. When couples do talk about it many times, it gets better. And yeah. I think no one tells you that, like, no, it's going to get, there's other layers of this onion to peel back, right? There's more to your sex life. So I think that is so awesome that you guys are there. But so you're asking, like, what does like a normal sex look?
Or I mean, like, the word like normal is like so silly, but I just like, right now we may be starting to use like sex as a crutch. Obviously there's so much more context that you need, but like just for anyone listening, what does healthy sex look like? What are some traits of maybe unhealthy sex? Like, how do you know if you have a good balance in your relationship?
Great question. I would say healthy sex looks like when both partners are consensually having sex. They both want to have sex. They have both talked about their turn-ons and their desires, and they know what feels good, and they know how to communicate that to a partner. I think it's when we're expressing our desires and our fantasies and our fetishes, and we have fully disclosed it to as much as we know at current day, because it's always changing, about what we actually want, and we're not having like performative sex. And I have to speak as someone with a vulva owner, as I say, like, I hope this is changing, but I don't think we're there yet. But where I was raised, and what I believe, that it was mostly about my partner's pleasure, not about my own. And so I always thought sex was good if my partner got off and they had pleasure. And like, for me, it was like, well, then I was a good lover, because I just did all these performative things that I thought looked good or would make them happy. And I think that making sure that there's parity, right, and that we have like agency over our bodies, and we get to choose and decide what we want, what turns us on. So to me, it's healthy when both of you are able to sexually express yourselves without, you know, shame and, I guess, performative faking things and all that. So that's what healthy, that's what I think, like, a healthy mindset around sex. And I always, like, I encourage couples to have a growth mindset around sex rather than it's fixed, because many people are like, this is how we have sex and we're going to do it this way, and I don't want to talk about it. Like, it shouldn't be talked about. Somehow we bought that sex is supposed to be this magical, like, unicorn rainbows happy place that there's just no talking and we talk about it, it just means it's not real. So those, you know, and then I would say as far as like frequency, which you want, always want to know, like that's the big question. Like, so doc, like how many times a week should we be having sex? And I am not prescriptive at all. I will never say, well, it should be, you know, 3 times a week. And so what I'm going to state there is that each couples get to decide what feels good to them. So like if you want sex 7 days a week and your partner wants sex 3 days a week, then there needs to be some compromise. But you're like, okay, so it's 4.5 days or it's, you know, it's something like we're acknowledging that. But if you're both satisfied with what it is and there is no problem, but typically people are asking this because it doesn't feel that even. But I would say that once a month probably isn't enough. And I would say that the average of life, what you hear is like probably once a week for many couples who have been in long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. Again, couples, you know, again, you decide. And I think that what happens in really healthy couples, and by healthy, I mean couples who talk about all this stuff and they're tracking their mental health and their sexual health alongside, like for many vulva owners, like this time of month, like if I'm getting my period, I'm not going to have sex on these days. And we often know that, but we don't feel comfortable saying it. Yeah. And for every woman, it's different. Like sometimes it's when they're ovulating or when they're actually having their period or it's 3 days before. And I want to empower them, women, to realize that you could track that. Like there's so many great places to track your cycle so you know that. But anyway, you're all figuring out the right times that it feels good. Like, is it morning? Is it night? This is like deeper work to do because we actually have all this information. Yeah. And then they just start continuing to like, you know, share what's our turn-ons, what feels good. So I would say healthy sex life looks like ones where you talk about it and you prioritize your own pleasure as well as your partner's.
Yeah, I think it's been cool for us as we have done some more personal work, both individually and together, has seen the like immense benefits that has had on our sex life as a result. So at least for me and for us, it's like it wasn't about the sex, right? Sex was a byproduct of this other shit that was going on that was like affecting the sex, and just kind of by looking at that and having some of those other conversations and dealing with other insecurities that I have and that she may have, like suddenly we're so connected again and like the sex is just fantastic now.
That's so good. That's so true. A lot of times the sex isn't even about the sex. The sex becomes a symptom of something else. Like the problem with sex is because you have resentments with your partner or you have stress or worry about other things. And when you can kind of resolve those things in the relationship, it's, yeah, you can come together again, right? Yeah, it's all connected.
I got a few more quick ones for you. I know your book that you wrote, how long ago was your first book?
Oh my God, my book came out about 10 years ago, Hot Sex, Over 200 Things You Could Try Tonight.
What was the like idea for that? Did you always know that you wanted to write a book or what was that experience like? And then now I know that you're doing it again.
I'm doing it again. Yeah. That book was honestly, I was starting out, maybe it was 12. I think that came out 12 years ago. And it was very early on when I was doing this work. But it was, what I loved about the book was that I was approached by this publisher who kind of hired me to like kind of execute on this. We want to show really cool positions of people having sex. And we want it to be much more like diverse. And we want it to be like a realistic portrayal of people having sex. So we used animation and we actually took pictures of people having sex, but then we animated it to make it a little bit more friendly. And so it was really just more like a quick, like kind of a coffee table book, but with like beautiful drawings that could sort of encourage people to find different positions and different things quickly that would turn them on from like, you know, being aroused from just like foreplay tips to like, I think it went up to like threesomes. So there was just a lot of different ways you could just open to any page and try different things. So
what are some of your, like your favorites or like easy ones for people to maybe try at home, like more on the beginner side of the 200?
I would say the beginner things are more about teasing. Like, I think that teasing is such a bad rap. Like teasing doesn't, it goes away sometimes after you first start a relationship. And what I'm talking about is like the anticipation. The foreplay, though, before you get into, because this is the other thing that's wrong with sex ed, is that it's so focused on penetration. Mm-hmm. Penis goes into vagina and that is sex. But what we found is for the majority of, especially vulva owners, and I would believe penis owners as well, that some of the sweet spots of sex and the really hot stuff is the buildup, is the massage and the touching and the getting intrigue about it and like the buildup and the like is it going to happen? Is it not? Or a peek at like something, you know, your clothes is kind of just wearing something that's sexy, but you just get a little hint of something, right? Rather than just full on sex. So I think it sort of peppers in these different ways that couples can play together that will, you know, continue to spark that arousal.
Yeah.
So that's the early part of the book.
Yeah. Well, be sure. I got to get myself a copy. I wanted to ask like something I just thought of that I would love for you to speak on. We have a lot of female listeners on the show and a lot of female fans of Mad Happy mainly. And I'm unable to comment on this, but I just had the thought of like how normal it is for girls and like women to have sex. And for some reason, like when I was in high school or college or whatever, like girls who have sex or put out or whatever get such a bad like reputation, and there's so much like slut shaming and like all of these things. I was just wondering if you could speak on like one, just like how normal these impulses and feelings and decisions that young women are having are, and like two, if you've heard a lot of that and have noticed any change in that being like normalized as we progress as a society.
That's a great question too. These are such good questions, because I do think that, again, this is an area where I have seen a little bit of evolution, but we're not quite there yet. Yes, I think definitely when a woman is having sex, that she has been slut shamed and she's been told that, like, you know, she, the more partners she has, people are going to talk about it. And it's more of a concern for women to feel like, if I have sex with this many people, then it's not okay, right?
Yeah, it's like the guy, like men, the guy gets a pat on the back and like the women gets like a scolded. Yeah.
Yeah, the women's like, he slept with all my friends. The great, let me have sex with them. You know, like then I should probably have sex with them as well. Like, right? But no, if that happened to a woman, like you banged everybody, like you're a slut. So there is such a disparity, and it's misogyny, and there's like so many reasons why that exists. What I saw the change to be, and where I think we're on the way. Okay, we're on a journey here. What I've seen the change to be is that there's just been whole in the last 8 years hookup culture. Like there was literally like 5 books that came out with hookup in the title, probably about 7 years ago. I was like, and I heard from a lot of young women who were like, I'm just empowered. I'm going to go have sex like a man, and I'm going to not worry about it. So I'm just going to like be that girl, be the cool girl.
Hot girl summer.
Hot girl summer, like whatever. I even had like a young friend, like when she was in college, and she was like, oh my God, you'd be so proud of me. Because I would talk to her, it was like a family friend. She's like, you'd be so proud of me. She's like, I went to this guy's house. It was in college. She's like, I gave him like 3 blowjobs. Then we got up and had pizza, and then we had sex, rolled over, and then I went home. And then I'm like, we're friends. And I'm like, she gets an FWB. I'm like, babe, where was your benefit? Like, please tell me what your benefit was in that. Is it because he bought dinner? And she, right. And I think she even said, no, like I brought in the pizza. I'm like, okay, so you literally had no benefit. So what I'm seeing is young women saying, yeah, I slept with him. I don't care that I did what I wanted to. But what we're missing here is that I believe that a lot of these young women are not having pleasure, that they're not, because they, this is the problem that I think that a lot of their male partners have no idea. I mean, the clitoris wasn't even medical literature until 1998. Okay. Like it's still a very new. Yeah. And the fact that penetration doesn't feel good for the majority, it doesn't produce orgasms for the majority of women, and sex is based on penetration. Like we're just left out of it. So we're left feeling like, why are we not having so much pleasure? So for these young women, for example, who don't know their bodies as well, they don't really know how to, even if they do know what feels good, they might feel weird asking their partner, because like, well, first off, we were wasted. That's the other thing. A lot of them using alcohol, and I'm going to get wasted and have sex, and it's very empowering. And I'm just like, is it really though? Like, so I think that the problem is in this communication and this understanding our own bodies, which is why the other thing that I want to encourage in sex ed is that masturbation is so healthy and normal. And in fact, it is such an integral part of being a sexual being and understanding what we need. So through masturbation, you can learn like, oh, I actually like this kind of stroke and this kind of touch. And this is what feels good to me. So when I'm actually talking about like heterosexual couples here, like a woman, you know, I can tell my partner what feels good to me, but you know, you aren't trained on it. Like I used to think that guys were shipped off to some secret school where you learned everything. Literally, I believed that until like an age I just not like to admit. Like I was like this, I was like probably my 20s or something. I was like, don't they know? Because I have no idea what to do. And it turns out like that's still the belief that I should know, or I feel bad. So I want to just empower and encourage, you know, so many, everyone, all of us, to just say like, I'm going to figure it out, or I'm going to be with a partner that I feel safe talking about what my needs are, what feels good. So I think we're still missing a big pleasure component.
Yeah. And on that masturbation piece, do you still find that there's a lot of like shame and like uncomfortability around that? Because I know when I talk to some of my guy friends, or like, it's like, oh, like you jack off like with your girlfriend, or like, where do you go? Or like, do you do it? Is that okay? Like, are you allowed to watch porn in relationships? Or like, is she doing it? Or like, it seems like this kind of like unwritten, like unsaid thing that people have a really hard time with. What do you think about it?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, I'm sorry. Literally the chapter I was writing 20 minutes ago, my book was all about this, that somebody was like, oh, in the chapter was like, we believe that once we get, for many, once I get into a relationship, I shouldn't have to masturbate. Or if I do, it's cheating. We have all these different beliefs around it. It should be private, you know? But I was saying too, the same thing happened to me when I found out in my early 20s that my boyfriend was watching porn. I saw the porn star that he was looking at, and like, she looks nothing like me. And my mind went to, well, he'd rather be with her than me, because I am not blonde. I'm not tall, you know, like, so we have so many misconceptions around masturbation and porn that, again, I know that for couples who talk about it, like, it amazes me how many couples have been together for years and years and never talk about it. And I just want to say like, why not? You're both doing it, or you both could be. And it's an important practice to maintain in a relationship, out of a relationship. It's a practice with yourself, right? And so it can be a big stress reliever. It doesn't necessarily mean like that you want more sex or less sex than your partner. It's like a very personal practice. That said, I love when couples talk about it. And then the next level thing, which I've helped a lot of couples with, a lot of listeners with, is mutual masturbation, has been like a game changer. Once we get everyone to the point of like, you're masturbating, is that cool? Like, let's do it. When couples who are in a good place actually both do it together, it's like this incredibly hot and informative. It's like a twofer experience. It's really hot because I think watching your partner get off could be just sexy and hot. But also the second part is you're learning what feels good. You're like, oh, I didn't know that my partner moves, you know, his hand that way around his penis. I didn't know that that happened. I didn't know that she did these things with her fingers. And then you're learning.
Right.
Like, so the next time I touch my partner, this is what I want to do. So yes, I think that couples have to kind of work this stuff out, because the messages from society is that for many, masturbation is cheating. You shouldn't have to masturbate. You shouldn't do it. It's bad to even fantasize about other people. And I'm here to tell you, your partner's going to fantasize about someone else. It's not popular. I know it, but you're not going to stop their thoughts. And it doesn't mean they don't want to be with you. So that's a whole nother conversation, but it's truly about, I know, because we were doing this today and some of my team was like, but isn't that bad? I'm like, no, like it's really not. Like it's going to happen. So the more I try to say, don't think about the hot barista you saw this morning, or your ex-girlfriend, or your you're going to. So if we just accept all of it as your sexual health and your sexual wellness, and it's all part of it, and you acknowledge it, and I'm not saying you say like, hey, babe, I had a great masturbation session. I was thinking about my ex. Like, no, like these are the things that we don't need to share, but not to like trip on those things, because your partner's with you and they're naked with you. And I'm going to assume that they actually really want to be with you. But since all this other sex stuff is so confusing and in society with just the wrong messages, it just gets messy.
Yeah. I think there's something very underrated about like putting ourselves first and like being selfish. Like I talk a lot about being selfish in like a healthy way, or like really having to put ourselves first in a lot of situations to avoid codependency or things like that. And I think like it does make me think of masturbation in the sense of like, if I just want to take care of myself or whatever, like that has nothing to do with you. Like I'm not saying that I like you any less, or I'm doing it because I do it better than you, or you can't do it. And yet when we don't have the conversation, these are the things that people assume, and then anxiety takes us to step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we're so far removed from reality, and that can just be such a slippery slope for couples and for people.
Exactly. And then we're hiding it, and then it feels shameful, and that becomes a problem. Now, it can become a problem. So you said you had sex addiction, or you are a sex addict, however you framed it. I guess you always are, right? And so to me, like, there's also controversy about that term even existing, but what I think you can look at is if there's a consequence. So for some people, like, watching porn too much is like they're, you know, maybe it escalates their what they want to keep watching. Then it's really hard for them to actually be with a partner because they're just seeing the porn, or there's a consequence where like they can't go to work because all they're doing is masturbating. Like, there's all these different ways that we can overdo everything. We can overdo sex. We can overdo, you know, but I guess I'm talking about the moderate, like that's all the things that we all have to work at in our lives, I guess, not being too, making sure that we're checking ourselves. But I would say, so I don't know if you had those experiences or how much you get into here, but I just want to say that for people to monitor that, and that if we do it in a healthy, balanced way, and usually if it's, we feel like we have a partner or a collaborator in this stuff, it will be less, it might help us.
For me, it was like I felt so alone about feeling sad and feeling less than, and I got sober from drugs and alcohol, so like I wasn't doing that anymore, and like porn and sex and love became this thing for me that was my drug in that way. So like I'm so alone and shameful and fearful that it's easier for me to just have sex with myself and this screen, and it can just be a contained experience where it's just all me and I'm still in my little bubble, and then like it's just so much easier than opening up the conversation and what is she gonna think about me, and no, I'm so embarrassed, like all of these fears that I would create in my mind, and it seems so silly to even talk about it now and think about it now, but when you're in it and when you're in that place, it's so paralyzing, and it's really so hard to see the other side, and you know, it's a shame that for me and for a lot of people, it usually takes something bad to happen or some sort of betrayal or like the gift of desperation in that way, that like only when we're about to lose something do we really be like, oh shit, like now I need to stop doing this shit, now I need to get serious. And like so much of what I'm passionate about and like what we try and preach is like, let's work on communicating and being able to intervene before you're at that rock bottom, potentially like life-changing place, so it can just be more of an ongoing thing. It doesn't need to be like make or break for us to be like, all right, now I'll get my act together.
Exactly. Sounds like you've done a really good job of that. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I'm still working on it a lot, but have like been able to stop watching porn. So like that's been really, really healthy for me, and was not easy, but has like significantly improved my relationship and just my mental clarity. And you know, I can actually sit and deal with my emotions now instead of just instantly trying to put a Band-Aid on it and medicate myself.
It's a journey. It's not easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. Well, I know it's a journey. What about for you? Like, do you feel like you've like mastered your like sex life and sexuality, or like, do you still struggle with things, or like, is it weird to like blend your personal sex life with your work, or has that been a challenge at all in any way?
No, I mean, I have to say it's also a really good question, because it's like, this is what I want to encourage people, that it's always changing. Like the sex that you want, it changes decade by decade. It can change year by year. It can change week by week. So once I've learned just how, I think it's kind of like mental health. Like we're kind of talking about the same things, right? Like you have days where you're really anxious, then days where you're feeling more open and creative. And then days, so like sexually, like I've learned to monitor, like there's definitely days where I'm feeling more into things and days where I'm feeling like I don't want sex. And then I look at why, and that's kind of what the book is I'm writing, is that you can look at it all like this. There's all these pillars that go into your sexual health. There's like your health, like have I been exercising? Have I been working out? Have I been eating good foods? Have I been taking care of my mental health? Have I been in therapy, right? The other things are like, you know, self-knowledge. Like how well do I actually know myself? Like why am I trying to have sex when my house is a mess? Like that doesn't work for me ever, right? So I know that I need to have my house clean, and then, you know, and then I go around the cycle of things like what might be keeping me from feeling in the mood or feeling desire or just anything. So I feel like what I have learned is how to kind of make sure that when I want to be monitoring my own sexual health, like, oh, I haven't been really feeling turned on lately. Oh, that's because, you know, I mean, I can kind of, that's what I've learned in all these years. I kind of know how to do that for myself, but it's definitely changed. Like I think it's all the time, again, knowing my cycle, knowing my moods, like just being able to monitor it, I think is really what has helped me. So it's, but I think people think that like with sex, like I won the award, like I'm the master sex instructor. So that means I learned how to like, you know, I'm the like master chef. Like I never learned another recipe again. Like it doesn't, you don't arrive anywhere with this. Like it's just always in flow and learning. I'm always learning new things all the time about mostly because the great thing is about sex is that I believe we can all learn to become great lovers to ourselves and to others. It's not about like a checklist as far as like, well, I learned how to do that position the best, or I learned how to do that. It's really not. I think a lot of people come to me, like if they listen to my show, like, I'm going to get skills. I'm going to get, and it's funny because someone said that today, like there was a review we got like at our iTunes. They're like, I came there for the positions and the whatever, but like I'm staying for the boundaries and the compassion and the communication. And he's like, that was really great. I'm like, yeah, you came in for the blowjobs and stay for the boundaries. And we were like laughing today, but it's like, you know what I mean? It's all connected. So I would say like the richer experience of being a sexual person and being evolved in this way is just that like I'm very self-aware.
Yeah, that it's such a great answer. And like, I'm so glad that we're talking about this because we talk about, you know, physical health and mental health being equal all the time. And like sexual health is right there, like on that tool belt, like totally in play with those. And I think it was great the way that you said it is like, I use my sexual energy and like that part of my life as an indicator of like how other things are going. Like if I'm not feeling horny, like what else is going on in my life? The same way as like if I'm feeling lethargic or if I feel like I'm going to cry, it's like that can be such an indicator of our overall well-being and mental health right there with all of the physical health and mental health symptoms and indicators.
Exactly. They're so closely related. It's and that's just kind of what I impart to people.
Yeah. My girlfriend is obsessed with your show. When I told her that you were coming on, she like freaked out, and then she was like, you have to call me to like help you prep and stuff. So I asked her like what I should ask you, and she sent me those like questions that you ask at the end of every episode. So I'm not going to ask you all of those, but a couple of the ones that I felt like would be very interesting were the last two in particular, which I would love to get your answer on. The first being like something that you would tell your younger self about sex and relationships.
Something I would tell my younger self would be to masturbate. Honestly, it would be to slow down, pay attention, and learn about my own body.
And what is the number one thing you wish everyone knew about sex?
Oh, God. I wish that everyone knew. No one's ever asked me these. It's so good that you're asking me my own questions. The number one thing I wish everyone knew is that, I guess it's a thing I've been saying for years, like communication is a lubrication. The more you talk about sex, the better sex you're going to have.
That's a great, tagline.
Thanks.
We also end every episode with two questions of our own, so I'll ask those to you now. The first being, if you could nominate anyone to come on our show who has been a big inspiration to you or who has a powerful mental health journey that you look up to, whether you know them or not, who do you think we should have on?
I'm so bad at these things of like right away thinking about...
I'm kind of interested in Dr. Ruth. I didn't really know that much about her, but just to hear you talk like lightly about her, it's like...
Oh my God, she's like 100 right now. You should have her on. Like she's literally like 95 and she's still talking about sex.
Have you worked with her?
I have. I had her on the show like 15 years ago, but we might be doing some other things together. Oh my God, who's the person about mental health that I've been inspired by? We were like, what's your favorite restaurant? I'm like, oh, I can't think of any restaurant. That's part of my executive functioning stuff here. I can't think of who.
It's all good. And lastly, Emily, what makes you mad happy?
Flow, when I'm in flow, creative flow state.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Love the work that you do. We can't wait for the new book. So we'll definitely be sure to link your show and link everything in the notes. I'll tell my family you send your love and thank you so much.
Please do. Yeah, and if you're in West Hollywood, I mean, yeah, your girlfriend, like, come get toys or whatever. Like, say hi.
Yeah.
We'll send you something.
Absolutely. Like, thank you so much.
Stay connected. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope that wasn't too uncomfortable for any of you guys. Mom, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I hope everyone was able to, you know, learn something about yourself, be able to get a fun new idea for your partner. Definitely check out Emily's show and book, and we'll put all those links in the description and everything. Hope you guys are enjoying the show. As always, if you are, please leave us a 5-star review and subscribe wherever you listen. And yeah, I know that was a new kind of episode. So if you guys have any other ideas about topics to cover or people to have on, again, we want you to be just as much a part of this show as we are, so please send those through. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll see you next week. Peace. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.